We're a couple of minutes early, but we're still getting people in.
Yeah, people always are ahead of us, so.
Good morning to Esther and Susan, the early birds, and Ronald, and Lee, and others.
Well, Mark, it's 10:30 Pacific time, so we can get started.
Okay. We have 15 minutes for the Q&A before the webinar starts. And we have one question left over from last week. And let me go to Ron from New York, who asks, do you know anything about the meteor that's supposed to hit the Earth in 2068?
Yes, that's the small asteroid called Apophis. And there was quite a bit of concern when it was predicted that it was going to strike the Earth in 2029. But as NASA astronomers began to measure with more and more precision, that probability of a collision kept dropping. And now that probability is zero. There's no way it's going to hit. On the other hand, it's going to come within about, I think it's 22,000 miles of the Earth. So it's going to be much closer to us, about 10 times closer to us than the moon, but it will definitely miss. And then in the late 2030s, it's scheduled to make another close encounter, but that encounter will be even more distant. So there's zero probability of that hitting. I think it's in 2038. 2068, there's still a very tiny possibility it could make contact with the Earth. The probability right now is rated at less than one chance in 500,000 that it would strike the Earth. So it's a very low possibility, but it's not yet at the zero level. And then there are also passes that will take place in the 22nd century, where those probabilities likewise are quite low. So I don't think that we're going to have any problems with Apophis. If it did hit, it would cause quite a bit of damage. I'm trying to recall exactly its size. I think it's about, in the neighborhood of 500 feet across. If you're interested, you can go to Wikipedia and put in Apophis. It'll pop up. It'll give you all the details. It'll also give you all the probabilities of it striking in the next couple of hundred years. But yeah, 2029 is not going to happen. And the closest possible encounter would be 2068. But right now, one chance of 500,000. And incidentally, NASA updates about every 3 months the probabilities of us being hit. And Apophis is one of the highest of possibilities of striking, but they're smaller bodies that have a higher probability of striking the Earth, but wouldn't do any significant damage. And the speculation has been, is this the Wormwood body that's predicted in Revelation chapter 8? If you read Revelation 28, it talks about an object in outer space striking the Earth and poisoning one-third of the world's fresh water supply. And that would require a fairly significantly sized asteroid. And the one place in the world where you got a third of the world's fresh water supply flowing is in what's called the Rocky Mountain Trench of North America, where all the major rivers of North America flow out from. What's interesting is that with the exception of the water out of that trench that flows into the Columbia, and a little bit that flows into the Missouri-Mississippi system, the rest of the water basically is untouched by humankind. It just flows untapped, unused into the Arctic, the Pacific, and the Atlantic Oceans. So for that prophecy to be fulfilled, I think we're going to have to wait for a time where a fresh water supply shortage occurs in the world, and people say we've got to tap that unused water supply. But right now, it's not being tapped to any significant degree.
Thank you. Doug McComb from Southern California asks, number one, will we eat food in heaven? And number two, if we will, what will we eat and drink? And why would we drink and eat?
Well, my son said that we hope it's not Brussels sprouts. So we do know we'll be eating in heaven because Revelation speaks about the wedding feast of the Lamb that we'll all get to participate in. And you say, well, how can that be if we've got bodies that are different than the bodies we have right now? Well, what's interesting is there are accounts in the Old Testament of angels eating. Angels are not physical beings like we are, but they have the capability of taking physical form, at least on a temporary basis. So the fact that angels are able to partake in the same kind of food that we eat means that there definitely is the possibility that we'll be eating in heaven. The distinction is, I think we'll be like the angels in that we can eat, but we don't need to eat. The angels can survive fine without eating, but evidently, if they choose to eat physical food, they can do so. So, and exactly what the food will be, I suspect it's going to be very enjoyable and tasty. And I think the reason why we see this reference to eating and feasting is it's interesting in terms of the way we humans engage one another and fellowship with one another. We notice that food and drink seems to enhance the intimacy and the conversation and fellowship we have with one another. So on that basis, I think, yeah, we're going to be eating in heaven. But the nice thing is you won't have to eat to survive. And yeah, what you do eat will probably be a lot better and tastier, more flavorful and colorful than the food we eat here. Frankly, I like Brussels sprouts, so I'm hoping there will be Brussels sprouts in heaven.
Hugh, is it possible that the references to food, you know, particularly the marriage feast of the Lamb, et cetera, are just symbolic of a union, symbolic of a kind of a marriage and a kind of relationship that's analogous to Earth, but not exactly like it?
Well, that's a good point, Mark, because many Bible scholars look at what Revelation describes and make the claim that it's all metaphorical and figurative. We shouldn't take anything that it states so literally. And so when it speaks about us feasting, it's referring to the level of communion and fellowship we'll have with one another. But one reason why I think that we can take at least some of it literally is that as you look at the entire book of Revelation, there are passages that must be literal. I mean, there are very sound doctrinal statements you see in the book of Revelation. And I don't think it means it's either or either. I mean, for example, when you look at the chapters on the seven churches in Revelation 2 and 3, I think there's ways that it's obvious that it's metaphorical and figurative, referring to the ages of the church, for example, or different kinds of churches. But also history tells us it actually literally applied to the churches that existed at the time that John was writing. So I think it's important to look at any prophetic passage of scripture and saying, what are the multiple ways that we can interpret this? So, and the very fact that angels were eating with Abraham, and the angels were eating, with Abraham and with Lot, tells us that, maybe we will be actually eating real food in heaven, but it will be different.
You know, with respect to those angels who were consuming food with humans on earth, is it possible that that was just done merely because they were transformed into earthly situations, but in heaven there wouldn't be any need for it? On earth, people do need to eat, and they join them. But is it possible that that doesn't carry over into their heavenly domain?
I think what's different, you know, angels can take on a physical form if they so choose, but they don't have to. On the other hand, what we learn in the book of Corinthians, that when we enter into the new creation, we will have physical bodies. And it implies that we're going to be permanently possessing those physical bodies. So it won't be exactly like the angels. The angels are spirit beings, but as spirit beings, they have the power to temporarily take physical form. As you see in the book of Genesis, the two angels that Lot entertained in his home, the citizens of Sodom presumed that they were humans just like Lot was. So evidently they were able to take the form. And in our book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, we make the point that angelic beings can take the forms of different non-living things, like flying saucers, or like leprechauns, or like human beings, or like one of your dead relatives, or like a dirigible float in the sky. Evidently, they have the power to take any physical form they choose. And people who've studied angelology do make the point, however, that some angels are better at it than other angels. So maybe it's kind of like us. If you don't practice it, you're not very good at it. I don't know. A lot of unanswered questions about angels. Likewise, a lot of unanswered questions exactly what our life will be like in the new creation. But we all can take comfort from what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 2:9. It's going to be better, more wondrous, more spectacular, more enjoyable, more loving than anything we can possibly imagine in our earthly state here. And so on that basis, I say whatever you come up with in terms of what you can imagine, it's going to be better than that.
Hugh, we still have a few minutes before the webinar begins, and we don't have any other questions pending, but I'd like to pose one about the, you know, the UFOs, or the residual UFOs, as it were. Why would the demons want to take a form of something like a spaceship that can violate the laws of physics as we know them?
Well, what we wrote about in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men is that the way these fallen angels manifest themselves to humans changes over time. I mean, these kinds of visitations have been documented for at least the past 3,000 years. I think it goes all the way back to Adam and Eve itself. But what's interesting is that they seem to be like one step ahead of our current technology, and always they're manifesting themselves in such a way as to deceive humans. So there's always a deceptive motive going on. And the other thing where they're kind of one step ahead, they're one step ahead of our technology, and they're one step ahead of our astronomical knowledge. And so we document, for example, that if you go back a few hundred years, these UFO beings were claiming to be from the backside of the moon. And now that humans are well aware that that's not a possible place for physical life, they changed their story, said that they were from the surface of Venus. And once humans became aware of how hot it was on the surface of Venus, They said, well, we're from Mars. And then now the people are aware that our solar system outside of Earth is not a very habitable place. They're now claiming to be from a distant planetary system. And it wouldn't surprise me that maybe they're going to change their story in the relatively near future and claim that they're from a distant galaxy. So they keep changing the context of their origin. And likewise, the way they appear to us. If you go back even just 100 years, they were coming to Earth on what appeared to be slow-moving floating dirigibles in the sky, because that was kind of the limit of our technology at that point. World War II, they were appearing as aircraft that were about the size of fighter aircraft of World War II, but moving 100 or 200 miles faster than the aircraft that was being piloted by people at that time. And today they are appearing to us in a spacecraft that are moving at about 25,000 miles per hour. You go back just a decade ago, two decades ago, the top velocity recorded where you had triangulation was 18,000 miles per hour. But now we got the technology to build spacecraft that can go 25, so they kind of upped their game to that point. And that tells me that there's something deceptive about their whole approach. Why do they keep changing the way they appear? Why do they keep in pace with our technology? And why do they keep pace with the astronomical knowledge of the general public?
Okay, thank you. We got to go a couple of questions here. Dig them up. From Tim Williams, we know particles can pop into existence, such as PAIRTS, P-A-I-R-T-S, and normally quickly go back out of existence. Does it work to extrapolate this to a universe size and get the universe popping into existence? Is this what Krauss is suggesting in his book?
Well, if you go to reasons.org, you can type in Lawrence Krauss's name, and that will pop up a lengthy review that I wrote of his book. I think it's in two parts. And basically, I deal with his book is titled The Universe from Nothing. And he claims as an atheist, there is no God. Nothing creates the universe. Nothing is unstable. And so out of nothing comes something. But as I'm in my review, I make the point that every one of his examples of nothing creating something, every one of his nothings is actually something. And probably the one that's got the most attention is one that Tim is raising. I mean, we do have examples of virtual particle production, where you get quantum space-time fluctuations in the space-time fabric of the universe popping into existence particles. And these particles are real and they're physical. What we notice is they return to the quantum space-time foam before any physicist can capture the particle and keep it. And the return time is quite brief, much briefer than a trillionth of a second. But we've done experiments in physics that actually proves that virtual particle production is happening, even though we're not able to capture any of these virtual particles and put them in some kind of storage bin. And what we do know, however, from quantum mechanics, is that the bigger the mass of the virtual particle that is produced, the faster it must return to the quantum space-time surface of the universe. And if you're talking something as massive as the universe, the return time is very much briefer than 0.000, and the number of zeros you would need is 121 zeros between the decimal point and the 1 second. That's so fast, so it'd have to return to the quantum space-time fluctuation. So as I wrote in my review of Lawrence Krauss's book, the analogy of virtual particle production cannot explain how the universe came to existence. The universe is way too massive for it to come into existence through that. Moreover, it dodges the question, where does the space-time fabric of the universe come from? That's not nothing, it's something. And we've known for decades in physics that the universe actually starts off with no matter and no energy, no electromagnetic energy. All it has is a space-time curvature. But the universe begins with extreme space-time curvature. The entire universe starts off as an infinitesimal volume. But as that infinitesimal volume expands, the space curvature in that volume gets stretched out. And it's the release of space curvature that first produces photons. So now you have electromagnetic radiation in the universe. Say, when does that happen? It happens a little bit before a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the cosmic creation event. And as the space-time fabric continues to unfold and the space curvature get released, you eventually get massive particles being produced. And that happens when the universe is younger than a billionth of a second after the cosmic creation event. And so space-time is not nothing, it's something. And just like you can convert matter into energy and energy into matter, you can convert space-time curvature into electromagnetic radiation and into matter. However, what's different from E equals mc squared, it's not reversible. You cannot take the matter and energy we have in the universe today and convert it into space curvature. We're not going to be able to return it to its original state.
It looks like we're into the webinar time now.
Okay, well, let's jump into the teaching part. And for those of you that are new here, the way this webinar works is that for the first 15 minutes, I take questions from last week or questions that are being raised by the current number of people. And then I teach for roughly 30 minutes. And then I take more questions. And we take questions on any topic, not necessarily those that pertain to the teaching. And then after that Q&A time, that typically runs for about 30 minutes, we go into a Zoom meeting. And that Zoom meeting, we can all turn our cameras on, our microphones on. And that's a time where I give you discussion questions, and we try to answer those questions. We get testimonies from participants. It's a time where we can really engage one another, because a number of you told me you really miss the fellowship and discussion time that was part and parcel of our Paradoxes class before the pandemic hit. But even before the pandemic hit, we had this live streaming option going on. And so what we're doing during the latter part of the class is actually allowing us to have that fellowship time. And I'll be giving you the link so that you can go from the webinar into the Zoom meeting. And the reason why we start with a webinar, not a Zoom meeting, a webinar is secure. Meeting is not secure. We got hacked when we did have it running as a meeting. So the only way you can get into the meeting is the first part of the webinar. So with that, let me share a screen and I'll launch it at the teaching time. Here we go. And you should all be seeing my first slide. And this simply gives you the URL you're going to need to get into the web meeting if you choose to be part of that. And the key part are those 11 digits you see at the bottom. That's what you're going to need. And by the way, once you get into the web meeting, be patient, because I need to take all of you out of the waiting room and bring you into the regular meeting. I just did upgrade my Zoom software, and I'm hoping they now have an automatic feature where I can bring all of you from the waiting room into the meeting. And in case that's not the case, be patient. As I see that you're in the waiting room, I'll promote you to the meeting. To get into that meeting, you'll need to leave the webinar. So exit the webinar, and then you can join the meeting. You'll not need a password. This is all you're going to need to be able to get in. Well, I thought I would begin the teaching time with something fun. It'll be quick. One of the things that really surprised me, I mean, I maintain a Facebook page and a Twitter page, and there I do take questions. So if you don't get to ask your questions during this Paradoxes time, feel free to pose questions to me on my Facebook and a Twitter page. I do my best to get to those questions. Then I use my Facebook and Twitter pages basically to keep people up to date on the latest evidences we have for the Christian faith. And sometimes I just try to post some photos that really display the wondrous beauty of God's creation. I mean, that's an apologetic tool. The fact that, God has created this universe and everything in it to display his glory, to display his elegance, his beauty, and his love. And so my hobby is nature photography, so sometimes I show a few photos of that. But I was surprised with the one that got the greatest response of all. It was a NASA photo. And I put this up just a couple of days before Halloween. Let me see what's going on here. Here we go. This is from a satellite that is continuously monitoring the tectonics of the sun. Yes, the Earth has earthquakes. The sun has starquakes. And this is an image of the sun where they change the illumination so that they can see the flaring activity that goes on around the sunspots. And this is from about a year ago where NASA basically demonstrated, hey, we alter the illumination coming out of the sun. It actually looks like a pumpkin. And I was shocked at what happened when I posted this on Facebook. I had almost 14,000 engagements of people. 138,000 people actually saw this. And that's by far, that's more than double I've seen from any of the posting I put on Facebook. And so yesterday, I decided to post something similar, which are galaxies that kind of look like a face. And so there are these two galaxies where you can see NGC 2292 and 2293. They're 120 million miles away, and they're in the process of merging to one another. But it does kind of have a face-like look. And then there's this one, where you got three galaxies. And this has been dubbed, it's the galaxies are NGC 6769, 6770, and 6771. They're 190 million light years away. And astronomers have referred to this set of three as the devil's mask, making it look like kind of a devilish-like face. And then there's this one here, where you're kind of looking at it, looks like a couple of eyes from a face there. This is 81 million light years away, NGC 2207, IC 2163. Anyway, that's on my Facebook page. And those are the galaxy pairs I've seen, or triplets I've seen, that most look like a face. So it is interesting, with the billions of galaxies out there in the universe, we can see some really interesting structures that are out there. And it says the heavens declare the glory and the majesty of God, the elegance and beauty. We definitely see that. Well, like last week, I'm going to begin with a short discussion of a scientific discovery, and then we're going to get into a lesson on what the Bible says about the benefits of suffering when we're suffering under the influence of the Holy Spirit. Bible makes it clear that Christians, people who are followers of Jesus Christ, will suffer in a different way from non-Christians, but they can suffer in a way where it can really bring them joy, and they can see the great benefit that comes from that. That's what we've been studying for the past few weeks, so that's where we're going to go. But I wanted to begin with a quite exciting discovery that got published a couple weeks ago. In fact, I got an article coming out. It's either going to come out this Monday or the following Monday. And it focuses on this mountain. And this is the highest mountain in Italy that's outside of the Alps. It's the highest mountain in the Apennine Range, almost 10,000 feet high. And what happened is that the Italians drilled a long tunnel right under this mountain. And when the physicists heard about this tunnel, it's actually a freeway, a four-lane freeway, two tunnels that go directly under. And that basically connects Rome to the Adriatic Sea. And so and it actually took off more than an hour of travel time to get to the Adriatic. But when the physicists found out about this throughfare underneath this mountain, the mountain's called Gran Sasso, they said, this would be a perfect place to build a laboratory where we would have complete protection from cosmic radiation. And so this actually shows the headquarters of what's called the Gran Sasso National Laboratory. And physicists and astronomers from all over the world come to this place to do experiments in the tunnels that exist underneath this mountain. And this map here shows you the tunnel. So that green line there is the A24 freeway that goes underneath Gran Sasso Mountain, off to the side, actually. And so what physicists did is they campaigned the Italian government and lots of other governments, because this is an international effort. And so they built another tunnel that took off from A24 and went directly underneath the highest part of Mount Gran Sasso. And then they carved out three gigantic caverns underneath the mountain, and several smaller ones as well. And this next slide shows you the most famous of the three experimental halls. They're called experimental halls. And to give you some idea, each of the large experimental halls measures 100 meters long, 20 meters wide, and 18 meters high. And for those of you used to imperial units, that's 330 feet by 66 feet by 60 feet high. So there's three of these large experimental physics caverns, and then several much smaller ones. And this one shows you the Gran Sasso neutrino detector. This is the world's most sophisticated neutrino detector. As you can see, it stands about 50 feet high. And this is the neutrino detector that's actually been able to measure neutrinos coming of the sun and determine exactly how much of the energy of the sun is coming from the proton-proton nuclear reaction, and how much is coming from what's called the CNO reaction, the carbon-nitrogen oxygen reaction. They've also been able to observe neutrinos flowing out from the thorium and uranium in the mantle and core of the Earth. But there's two more gigantic physics laboratory centers, and one of them is responsible for a major breakthrough in giving us even more evidence for the biblically predicted Big Bang creation model. And I've gotten some reaction from atheist physicists when I make the term biblically predicted Big Bang creation model. This is actually part of my conversion story, reading through the Old Testament and seeing multiple passages in the Old Testament that told me that the universe has a beginning that implied a beginning of space and time itself. 11 texts in the Bible that state that the universe expands from a cosmic beginning, and 7 different texts that talk about how the laws of physics that govern the universe are unchanging, they're fixed, and how the entire universe is subject to a pervasive law of decay. And, you know, as a young man of 17 and 18, having been studying astronomy and physics since I was 7, I realized, okay, if the universe has a space-time beginning, if it expands from its beginning under laws of physics that don't change, or one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, then the universe must get colder and colder in a highly predictable way. And when I joined the ministerial staff of a church, Christ Church in Sierra Madre is what it's called now, situated between Caltech and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I wound up doing some TV shows on the Trinity Broadcasting Network, a theologian in one of those shows talked to me after the episode and introduced himself as John Ray, a Hebrew scholar and a theologian. And he said, I've heard you talk about this Big Bang stuff. As a Hebrew scholar, I want to share with you that indeed you're correctly interpreting these texts. Yeah, the Bible really is claiming that there's ongoing cosmic expansion. And so John and I wound up writing an article back in 2000. And it's on our reasons.org website. And the article basically says, Big Bang, the Bible taught it first. This is what it looks like. And there we go through all these different biblical texts to demonstrate that indeed the Bible did predict the Big Bang model for the universe thousands of years before any astronomer even had a hint that the universe had these characteristics. The pushback I got from a number of atheist physicists was that, well, Hugh, you're reading this into the text from a 21st century perspective. I said, well, wait a minute. I was reading this into the text back in 1970. And that was long before we really had strong evidence that the Big Bang creation model was correct. And moreover, I'm not alone. Jewish scholars hundreds and thousands of years ago also saw this in the text. And they basically said, prove it. And so that's this article. It was written. It's also at reasons.org. It's in my blog series called Today's New Reason to Believe. And the title is, Does the Bible Teach Big Bang Cosmology? And what I do in this piece is basically document Jewish scholars like Maimonides and Maimonides that lived 800, 900, 1,000 years ago, 1,100 years ago, who came to the same conclusions that I did and John Ray did, basically making the point, this is not just hindsight interpretation. Jewish scholars, long before any hint in astronomy that the universe had these characteristic features, were reading the Old Testament, what they called the Tanakh, and drew these conclusions. Well, that's not really what this research paper I'm referring to talks about. What it talks about is how we've been able to come up with a far more definitive test, a proof that indeed the universe can be traced back to a Big Bang creation event. And this map that you see here is the very best map we have of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, otherwise known as a cosmic background radiation. And this is a map that was published in 2018. Based on the data taken by the Planck satellite that was commissioned to measure with the highest sensitivity possible the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. This is what the universe looked like long before stars were forming. It's actually looking at the universe when atoms first began to form. And that happened 380,000 years after the cosmic creation event. And what this basically shows you is what the universe looks like when the first atoms began to appear. The appearance of the first atoms for the first time actually allows us to see the temperature differentiation in the universe. So the orange colors you see there represent the cosmic hot spots. The blue colors represent the cosmic cold spots. But keep in mind that the difference between the hot spot and a cold spot is about 100 thousandths of a degree Kelvin. So we're talking about very tiny temperature differences. But as you look at this map, all those little orange spots that you see there, they become future clusters and superclusters of galaxies. And the blue spots become the voids between the clusters and clusters of galaxies. And one of the great successes of Big Bang cosmology is that we now have detailed maps of the positions of the clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies, and they perfectly match what we see here in the radiation of the universe 380,000 years after the beginning of the universe. But two of the what are considered to be the most definitive tests, proofs that the universe really did arise from the Big Bang creation event, is what's called the primordial helium abundance and the primordial deuterium abundance. And I write about these in my book, The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition. And what this new research is doing, based on studies done underneath this mountain in Italy, is giving us a much more definitive test or proof of the Big Bang creation model based on the deuterium abundance of the universe. You say, what on earth is deuterium? Deuterium is heavy hydrogen. And so you've got light hydrogen. Hydrogen is the lightest of the elements in the periodic table, and it consists of a single proton. Heavy hydrogen or deuterium is where you've got a proton linked with a neutron. And so that's deuterium. And 100% of the deuterium in the universe, according to the Big Bang creation model, is made in the first 4 minutes after the cosmic creation event, because it takes nuclear fusion to have a proton linked together in a nucleus with a neutron. And, between about 3 minutes after the cosmic creation event and 4 minutes after the cosmic creation event, the universe goes through a temperature window. When the universe was infinitesimally small, it was infinitely hot. But as the universe expanded under this pervasive law of thermodynamics, it became cooler and cooler and cooler. And between 3 and 4 minutes after the cosmic creation event, it passed through a temperature window of about 300 billion degrees and 17 billion degrees. And that's the temperature range where nuclear fusion occurs. And it's in that brief moment. It's about a 20-second wide window of time, previous to 4 minutes after the cosmic creation event, when the universe that was nothing but protons and neutrons got transformed into a universe where you had hydrogen, helium, and deuterium, and a very, very tiny amount of lithium. I'm not going to address the lithium. That is addressed in detail in the Crater of the Cosmos 4th edition, so you can look at that. But what I want to focus on here is the deuterium. And the test I talked about in the Crater in the Cosmos 4th edition, that came out in 2018, is that you look at what's called the ratio of deuterium to light hydrogen. And we can, and okay, again, stars destroy deuterium. They do not make deuterium in their nuclear furnaces. So according to Big Bang cosmology, 100% of the deuterium that we have in the universe came from the first 4 minutes after the cosmic creation event. And so what astronomers do is they look at very distant gas clouds where star formation has yet to occur. So they're looking like 13 billion light years away, far enough away that we're looking far enough back in time that there's been no star formation. And if you don't have star formation, you don't have a stellar nuclear process that destroys the deuterium. And so that's a way that they can look at what's called the primordial deuterium abundance. Simply look at gas clouds so far away that there hasn't been any significant destruction of deuterium by stars. And then by looking at the spectra of those distant gas clouds, they can determine the abundance of deuterium relative to the abundance of light hydrogen, so measuring heavy hydrogen to light hydrogen. And what they've been able to measure to relatively high precision is that it's 2.527 plus or minus 0.030 times 10 to the minus 5. So there's about 2.5, so it's about 1-2 parts in 100,000 of deuterium relative to hydrogen. And then what astronomers have done is they've looked at the Planck map of the cosmic background radiation, the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event according to the Big Bang creation model, and have been able to calculate on that basis what the primordial deuterium abundance was. And so the fact that these two numbers agree is cited as proof, one of the proofs that indeed the Bible got it right, that the universe originated from the Big Bang creation event. But what you notice here is the error bar based on this theoretical calculation, assuming that the Big Bang creation model is correct, the error bar is almost 3 times bigger than what we can measure of the primordial deuterium abundance in gas clouds. Here you see it's 2.494 plus or minus 0.082 times 10 to the minus 5. As I cited in the Crater of the Cosmos 4th edition, note that the two numbers agree to a relatively high precision, but a group of physicists said we can do better, because what they were pointing out was that the limitation in calculating how much deuterium there should be if the Big Bang creation model is correct is the fact that we do not have a really accurate measurement of the nuclear cross-section of the deuterium burning reaction. I mean, you know, how deuterium gets destroyed. And so, and the reason why is that cosmic radiation interferes with our ability to measure that nuclear cross-section to the degree of precision that physicists desire. And so what they did is they said, well, one way we can deal with this is go to Grosso, Senso Grosso. And so they said, let's supply, and their application was accepted. And so they went into one of these deep chambers. And to give you an idea of the protection you got from cosmic rays, when you go to Grand Sasso Mountain, there's literally 1,400 meters of solid rock above you. And that's enough solid rock above you to stop any cosmic rays in any significant way from interfering with your measurements. And I think that translates to about, that's about 4,700 feet of solid rock above the laboratory. And so with that, they were able to measure the nuclear cross-section to high precision, and therefore significantly reduce the error bar on what the Big Bang creation model predicts for the deuterium to light hydrogen ratio. And this is what they were able to publish. This got published about 2 weeks ago, 2.52 plus or minus 0.04 times 10 to the minus 5. What you notice here, it's right bang on what you get from observations of the deuterium to hydrogen abundance in distant gas clouds. Moreover, the team says, we notice that the observations in distant gas clouds are still slightly more precise than what we can get from what we would predict for the Big Bang creation model. But they said, we can continue doing measurements under Mount Gran Sasso and actually reduce the error even more. So they're hoping that within perhaps another year, they'll be able to come up with another study that actually gives accuracy that's just as good as what we get from measurements in distant gas clouds. Meanwhile, astronomers are saying, we think we can reduce the error bar in the measurements of deuterium to hydrogen abundance in distant gas clouds even more so than we have already. But notice, it's already down at the 1% level. And so there's actually an effort to try to get an accurate measurement that's better than 1% precision, both by direct observations and by deduction from the Big Bang creation model. But already this is a spectacular agreement, and it ranks as one of the best proofs that indeed the universe arose from a Big Bang creation event exactly as the Bible predicted thousands of years ago. So with that, let's jump into our lesson on suffering, what the New Testament says about suffering in the context of how followers of Jesus Christ, who have been indwelt by God's Holy Spirit, have received the baptism of the Holy Spirit, as talked about in the book of Acts, chapter 2, chapter 8, and chapter 10. And yes, there are three different days of Pentecost, one for the Jews, one for the Samaritans, and one for the Gentiles. But after that third day of Pentecost, whenever anyone gave their life to Jesus Christ, submitted their lives to his authority, and received the offer of redemption that he made available through his death on the cross, at that moment, they become permanently indwelt by the Holy Spirit. They become the salt of the earth, which prevents societal reprobation. But also, they become equipped to really benefit in marvelous, miraculous ways from the suffering that is the way it is for all human beings. All of us suffer because we're all living in a universe where there's gravity, electromagnetism, and thermodynamics. As I've mentioned before, those are crucial tools in God's hand to permanently eradicate evil once and for all. But right now, we're being exposed to that. And we're exhorted in the New Testament as followers of Jesus Christ to actually use the suffering God takes us through in ways to bring about a greater good. just like God is temporarily putting us through evil and suffering to bring about a greater good, so that even applies at an individual level in the lives of followers of Jesus Christ. And so we began with this text in James. I'm going to give a quick review here, and then we're going to jump into where we're going to have an in-depth study. James says, consider it pure joy. I mean, when I first read that as a non-Christian, I said, how odd. James is telling us to be joyful in all the suffering we go through. Why would we be joyful about suffering? But he makes this point here. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Basically making the point that if we're to grow, mature, and becoming more Christ-like, a key component is developing perseverance. And that's one of the benefits of going through the suffering we go through. Just like all of us suffer as we go through, say, a college-level course, or go through any kind of occupational training, the whole focus is to develop perseverance so we can be successful in our future careers. And that's a point that James and Peter and Paul are all making, is that the suffering we go through is basically developing perseverance within us and training so that we can be successful in our future careers, the new creation. We are headed towards very challenging and very fulfilling careers in the new creation. And a study question we looked at when we went through this in depth, how can we better discern the benefits of our perseverance and Christ-likeness? And what evidence do we have of our growing perseverance and joyful spiritual disciplines? Got a number of really good testimonies from several of you on that. Then we looked at this text in 1 Peter 4:12. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you're suffering, as though something strange were happening to you. Peter's basically saying, this is the norm for the Christian. But he makes the point that as a follower of Jesus Christ, that we're going to suffer more than non-Christians will, but we're also going to benefit more from our suffering than non-Christians will. But rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. So there's always this joy that comes out of it. And then this is the study question we looked at in our Zoom meeting. How can we better discern when our painful trials are for Christ's sake rather than a consequence of our own foolish behavior? And how can we better anticipate and work for the glory that is to come? How can we actually fully benefit from that promised glory? And then we looked at this text here in Romans 8, 17 to 18. We are heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share in his sufferings, in order we may also share in his glory. And our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. And last week, in our web meeting, we looked at these four questions. How can we welcome but prepare for persecution? How can we benefit? And that's really the context of this text. How can we welcome and prepare for persecution? How can we benefit from persecution? How can we discern whether the persecution is for Christ's sake or just because we're not behaving in a very Christ-like way? How can we measure the difference between our sufferings and the glory that will be revealed? And that takes us up to where we left off last week. This is the URL you're going to need to get into the meeting where we're going to handle the discussion questions based on the next text. I'll pop up this Zoom address again. But the passage we're going to be looking at today is in Romans 8:28, probably one of the best known passages in the book of Romans. I know many of you have this memorized. In all things, God works for the good of those who love him and who've been called according to his purpose. It's basically making the point, as a follower of Jesus Christ, no matter how bad things get in your life, think of the worst things that have happened in your life. Every one of those events, God's going to work it out for good, a far greater good than any rough experience you have. all things, and all things, good or bad, even the most extreme bad events that have happened in your life, even the most extremely painful. And when it talks about painful, we're not just talking physically painful, but emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually painful. Think of the worst things that have happened. The promise here is it will work out for good, a good that far outweighs any bad that you've experienced in this life. But notice there are two conditions. All things will work together for good for those who love God and have been called according to his purpose. This is why, as a pastor, I make such a point in my ministry of telling people, you need to discover the purpose which God has created you. And your purpose is not the same as my purpose. It's not the same as anybody else's purpose. God has called you to a specific purpose. And so we all need to be committed to find out what that purpose is. But if you're fulfilling the purpose for which God created you, and if you have this strong love for him, the promise is no matter what happens in your life, it's going to work together for good. So that's what we're going to be talking about today as we go into the web meeting after our webinar time. And these are the questions we're going to be looking at. What forms do the good take? I mean, it doesn't really tell us in this text. This just says good will happen. The good will be greater than the bad. But what forms do the good take? How can we better anticipate the good that is told us is going to come? And how long does it typically take for the good to arise? Sometimes it's quick, sometimes it's not so quick. And how does patiently waiting for the good mature us in Christ? How does it make us more Christ-like? Those are the study questions, but I'm going to begin with this. When we go into our web meeting after our webinar time, after we're done with the Q&A section, I want several of you to give an account of an event in your life that looked like it could only work out for bad. In other words, when you're going through it, there's no way anything good could come out of this. This is totally bad. But as you began to exercise patience and perseverance in due time, it worked out for something that you couldn't even imagine. It worked out for something unimaginably good. And that, in that case, you're grateful for going through the trial, for the painful experience, for the suffering you went through. And what I'm going to do when we get in the web meeting, I'm going to give you two short stories of how this worked out in my life. But then I'm going to have various ones of you likewise. And I think, as a matter of fact, this is the challenge I have for each one of you. I want each one of you to be able to give an account of an event, because we're going to run into people who are not yet followers of Jesus Christ. And we talked to them about Romans 8:28. Matter of fact, I've had a number of unbelievers bring this up to me and say, hey, I see this text in Romans 8. There's no way this can be true. That's the time when you need to be ready to give a personal account of an event in your life that looked like it could only work out for bad. There's no way it could work out for good. And then be able to share how in due time it did work out for good, and good at a level far beyond what you could imagine at the time you're going through the trial. And so I'm basically encouraging each one of you, be ready to give that kind of account. This is one of the ways we can apply 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to give a good reason. Always be prepared to have a good answer to the questions that people will pose to you with gentleness, respect, and a pure conscience. And my hope today is as the various ones of us give accounts of events in our personal lives, it's going to cause you to say, no, wait a minute, I now remember. So I'm hoping this will stimulate your memory, and likewise, each one of you will be able to give an account. So that's what we're going to be doing today. We go into the web meeting, but I see I'm now a little bit past the 30 minutes. So I'm going to exit the screen share and I'll turn it back over to you, Mark, where we'll take questions. And we'll take questions for, let's say just the next 20 minutes, and then that'll leave us adequate time to have a good sharing time when we go into our web meeting. So 20 minutes of questions, then we'll segue into our web meeting. And yes, once again, I'll pop up the URL in case you didn't get to write it down. It's the same URL we've been using for the last 3 weeks.
Okay, thank you. First question is from Ronald. He says, to follow up on Jesus coming for a 1,000-year reign here, would he stop an ice age to make it nice, even if just for himself?
Okay. Well, not all Christians believe that Jesus will actually literally reign on earth for 1,000 years. I'm personally in the camp of Christians that do. They refer to us as premillennialists, where we actually believe that Christ will reign for 1,000 years here on planet earth. And I think one of the strongest biblical evidences that that interpretation is likely to be correct is the fact that we see God locks up Satan and the Antichrist for 1,000 years before any human being gets locked up into hell, and how he'll be released at the end of 1,000 years to test the children that are born during this 1,000-year reign of Christ. Now, some scholars try to find a way to take that completely figuratively, but as I read that part in Revelation 19 and 20, it gives me a strong motivation to take what the Bible says about the millennium as a literal 1,000-year reign here on planet Earth. And yes, as I read the texts that talk about this 1,000-year reign, those are Isaiah and Revelation, it seems like conditions are going to be extraordinarily pleasant here on Earth during that 1,000-year reign. I mean, Jesus Christ will be the prime minister of planet Earth. You're going to be able to see him on television every day or some kind of equivalent to that. Who knows what technology we'll have at that time. And my theology of the millennium is that God takes away every human excuse for why we sin except the real reason. So he says, hey, you think it's a bad government that made you sin? I'm going to have a government and in no way you can find fault with it. We all find fault with politicians in our government. He says, when this reign sets up, it's going to be a perfect government. You can't blame the government anymore. And, you know, we're going to have, these perfected Christians that are going to be magistrates. They're going to be rulers. So you can't say, well, it's the police. It's the magistrates. Hey, these are people who have been perfected through the work of the Holy Spirit. They have no sin in them anymore. They're sin-free, so you can't really blame them. But likewise, it's going to be a great environment, so you can't blame environmentalism. What I find interesting, it's also a time when God says, we're going to artificially feed all the carnivores. And so the carnivores aren't going to have to kill anymore, because people look and say, look at all this bloodshed in the natural world. And of course, somehow that's going to be, we're going to have a way to manage the herbivores so they don't overpopulate, they don't get disease. Christ will be ruling, so he'll be able to do all that. So you're not going to be able to blame carnivorous activity anymore. People are going to be living for hundreds of years. It tells us that a man will be considered to have died in his youth if he dies when he's only 200 or 300 years old. So evidently, long lifespans will be restored. Because again, that's a common excuse for why people sin. But on that basis, I would have to agree that it's not likely that there's going to be an ice age. And that's interesting because, you get an ice age that lasts for 90,000 years, and you get a warm interglacial that lasts for 10,000 years. That's kind of what the ice age cycle has been like for the last 800,000 years. And we've gone about 13,000 years since the end of the last ice age. So this is the longest interglacial we've seen in the entire ice age cycle. And then we're going to add another 1,000 years to that. Well, you can read my book, Weathering Climate Change. I make the argument in that book that there are things we can do in the way we manage planet Earth where we can extend this current highly stable climate, the warm interglacial end, probably for about another 14 or 1500 years. After that, I don't think it's possible, but that gives us plenty of time to have a 1,000-year reign of Christ. But that also tells me we're going to be seeing the return of Christ to planet Earth in that interpretive context sometime within the next, say, 400 or 500 years. So we're not looking at thousands of years for the Lord to return in that particular interpretive context.
Thank you, Hugh. Doug McComb asks, how many of the elements of the periodic table are inside or on the surface of the sun?
Well, the 98 elements we see here on planet Earth, we also see them in the sun. So the sun is about the same age as the Earth, and so it's not really surprising that we see the same set of elements. If you go back in time, the sun had Neptunian and technetium and plutonium. Earth likewise had all those radioactive elements, but we don't have them anymore, mainly because their half-lives are so short, only in the millions of years, that they completely decayed away. On the other hand, in the case of both the sun and the Earth, we see the daughter products of those once existing elements. So we have proof, for example, that plutonium did exist on the Earth for, say, its first billion years, because we see the daughter products of the decay of plutonium existing on the Earth today, the non-radioactive decay products. And if Doug's got a follow-up question, I'll be happy to take it.
Thank you. Susan asks, can the neutrino detector tell us if a major flare is going to be headed towards Earth, or is it not directional at all?
Yeah, the neutrinos coming out of the sun cannot tell us if there's a future flare happening, mainly because the neutrinos that come to us from the sun's nuclear furnace, they get here within 8 minutes, about 8.5 minutes. They arrive at the neutrino detector under Gran Sasso Mountain. The photons from that nuclear furnace take 100,000 years just to get to the surface of the sun. Then they take 8 minutes to get the rest of the way to the Earth. So what we're seeing with the photons is what was going on in the core of the sun 100,000 years ago. What we see the neutrinos of what's going on right now, but what it's telling us is what's going on in the nuclear core of the sun. It's not really giving us any information of what's happening at the surface of the sun or the layers that are just underneath the surface of the sun. And that's where the flares happen. And so, yeah, we get no information from the neutrinos about the flares. Now, if you want advance notice, you can get advance notice. So, for example, if there's a major flare on the sun, it takes about 24 hours before it impacts the Earth's magnetosphere. So, yeah, you get 24-hour notice of a major impact from a solar flare on Earth's magnetosphere. And people have actually taken advantage of that because when you get a really big flare, you're going to get spectacular aurora borealis. And a lot of people have never really seen a very good auroral display. And so they look at the NASA website and they say, okay, a major flare happened today, and it looks like it's heading in a direction that could impact our magnetosphere. I'm going to book a flight to Iceland, or I'm going to book a flight to Whitehorse in the Yukon, or to Fairbanks in Alaska, and get a really good look at the aurora borealis. It also gives you a 24-hour notice. Say we got a really, really big flare, like the one that happened in 1859. That gives you 24 hours notice to protect the power grid, because a really big solar flare will destroy the electrical power grids of the world. Unfortunately, 24 hours notice is not enough to protect those grids. And I know of only one power grid that's adequately protected. That's the province of Quebec power grid, because they got knocked out. I think it was in 1989. They got knocked out by a major solar flare. And because Quebec is so close to the North Magnetic Pole, they got the biggest hit and actually knocked out their power grid for a 24-hour period. which, because Quebec supplies a lot of electricity to Boston and New York and other major cities, as well as Montreal and Quebec City and Toronto, they wound up losing $11 billion. And so they thought it was worthwhile to spend $1 billion to protect the power grid. So it's now protected, but the rest of the power grids of the world are not protected. And that's why I've argued in Weather and Climate Change, we know a major solar flare is inevitable. They happen about once every couple of hundred years, and therefore it'd be worth taking on an insurance policy of spending a few tens of billions of dollars to protect the world's major power grids so that when a big flare happens, we retain our electrical needs, because we need electricity today to maintain a population of 7.5 billion humans. Without an electric power grid, we're not able to feed the world's population.
Thank you, Hugh. Susan Lambeau asks, does infinitely hot actually mean infinitely hot or just extremely hot? And I think she's referring to the Big Bang event.
Right. Well, that's a good clarification, Susan, because what the physics tells us, it's either infinitely hot or near infinitely hot. And the universe begins either infinitely small or near infinitely small. We don't have the physics to be able to distinguish between the two. So I think a proper way to refer to about it is, think of the universe beginning as a near infinitely shrunken volume and beginning with a near infinitely high temperature. So thank you.
Okay, we have a question from Jay from Arizona, who says, what do you think the big lie will be that fools almost everyone? Quote, B, capital B, capital L, big lie.
Yeah, I think he's referring to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Matter of fact, let me get my Bible out here. Might be good just to actually look at that particular text. Yeah, here it is. The coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. They perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion, so they'll believe the lie, and so that all will be condemned who have not believed the truth, but have delighted in wickedness. It's basically making a point here that we need to value truth more than we value power. But it's a temptation that many of us face, is that there's this desire of humans to seek for power. And if we put our priority for power ahead of priority for truth, this text and other texts of the Bible is not alone. It's saying if you put your priority on gaining power and gaining wealth and power over other people capacity over truth, you will be deceived. It's a promise, you will be deceived. And hence we need to put a priority on truth. And notice here it's referring to how this is going to be accompanied by miracles, signs, and wonders. And so I think how this big deception is going to take place, we're going to have this being, a human that'll be empowered by Satan, who is going to do wondrous miracles in front of the world's population. And based on those miracles, make the point, hey, I've got power, and I'm prepared to give you power as well. If you will submit to me, if you will make me your ruler, then the power that you've seen me display, I'm going to give, not to the same degree, but I'll make it available to you. And so it's basically, and basically making the point, given that I have all this power, I must be the one that you should follow and worship. So basically the big lie will be, I'm more powerful than this God that you think exists. And I, in fact, are the one. And so that's the huge lie. And basically, and we know that because what we see in other texts, particularly the book of Revelation, the one that performs these miracles, signs, and wonders is going to be demanding that every human being worship him as if he is God himself. So that's the big lie. He's going to convince people he is the one that has all the power, and that we're fooled in thinking that there's a God that has features different that works us. In fact, we're warned in Matthew 7 that unbelievers likewise can perform miracles, and therefore we shouldn't look at miracles. We're to test them to see where the miracles are coming from. Are these miracles from God, or are these miracles coming from the evil one? Satan is the most powerful being that God created. He has the power to perform miracles, not at the level that God does. Doesn't have the power that God does. That's a great deception. A great deception is, I'm the most powerful thing that you can ever encounter. And incidentally, we see that in demonology, in cultures of the world where they're under the oppression of demons. What the people there have been persuaded to believe is that this demonic power they see is greater than any other power that's possible. And therefore, they live in subjection to that power. And how do they get out of it? By recognizing there's one more powerful. One more powerful who actually loves them and wants to communicate truth to them and not lies. And that, in my opinion, is what this great delusion is all about. And I'm first to admit, there are other interpretations of this. And so you're welcome to go online, read other texts, because there are differences of opinion in the Christian community as to what this powerful delusion is. But that's my take on it.
Thank you, Hugh. Mark Durham asks, the preterism viewpoint states that Bible prophecy events have already occurred. What events do they believe have already occurred, and how does this relate to amillennialism?
Yeah, there are several different forms of preterism, but what they have in common is that to some degree, what happened in 70 AD is the fulfillment of the Olivet Discourse. Olivet Discourse is given in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. And this is when the disciples asked Jesus, what will be the sign of the end? And Jesus says, well, these will be the signs of the beginning of the end. And the preterists are claiming all those signs were fulfilled in 70 AD. And they can document historical records that establish that indeed the events that Jesus said would happen indeed did happen in 70 AD. So they're basically saying, that's it. We shouldn't look for any more end times fulfillment. They're the same people who discount the rebirth of Israel as a sign of the coming of the end. They said, no. These texts that talk about the second rebirth of Israel, a nation, are referring to the church. They're not referring to the Jews rebuilding their nation in the land of Israel. That's got nothing to do with these Bible prophecies. And I have to deal, I'm not a preterist. I have many friends that are preterists. Excuse me. But what I point out to my preterist friends is you need to realize that the disciples asked Jesus two questions, not one question. And you see, the only text of the Olivet Discourse where you see the two questions is in Matthew 24. But Matthew 24 is the one that gives us the most content about the Olivet Discourse that Jesus preached. And so we should take that text quite seriously. And the two questions the disciples ask, they look at the second temple, and they said, look at this magnificent temple. And Jesus, and then they said, how long is this temple going to last, and when will you return? And then Jesus basically said, these things will happen. But basically, he was answering two questions. When will the second temple be destroyed? And when would he come back again? And those are two different events. They're not one and the same. Preterists will say they're one and the same, but you could easily interpret that text. Those are two distinct events, the destruction of the second temple and the second return of Christ here to planet Earth. Or the return of Christ to planet Earth. And in that case, I would argue that the prophecies you see in the Olivet Discourse are going to happen twice. not once. They did happen in 70 AD. I don't discount that. I don't argue against that. I'm saying they're going to happen again. And when they happen again, they will precede the soon return of Christ to planet Earth. And actually, I think there are a number of things in place already that could bring about the fulfillment of those Olivet Discourse predictions. Now, there are Bible scholars out there that are claiming that these events have already happened. I'm not in that camp. I think we need to interpret those events in the context of a large fraction of the human population being impacted by what Jesus says. So when it talks about earthquakes, you know, people were claiming, for example, the earthquake that had a major impact on Tientsin in China and killed 800,000 people a few decades ago. This was the event. And it's like, no, there's going to be earthquakes in several places. And not just earthquakes like you see off of New Zealand that don't kill anybody. These are earthquakes that do significant damage and have a death toll associated with it. So Sunday is way above the average. And that, frankly, that's how I interpret the Olivet Discourse. Events that are way above the average in terms of their impact on humanity and human activity. So, and by the way, there are many examples in the Bible of double prophecies. Probably the most famous example is the one in Isaiah about the virgin giving birth to a child. If you read that text, it's two different virgins at two different times. One being the future wife of Isaiah, and the other one being the predicted woman who would give birth to the Messiah. Two different women, two different virgins, and two different times in which it would be fulfilled. And likewise, another example would be Daniel chapter 9, which basically makes the point that the Messiah would come at two different times, not just one time.
Thank you, Hugh. We have three more questions, but we're bumping into the time that you wanted to go into the meeting.
Yeah, let me take the shortest of the three questions, and then we'll save the rest for next week, because I do want to save time for a meeting.
Okay. What about the radioactive decay interfering with the neutrino detection under Gran Sasso?
Excuse me. That's a good question. There's a reason why they chose Gran Sasso, because it's dolomite in structure, which means limestone. And so by choosing a limestone mountain, that means it'll be a mountain where there wouldn't be a lot of residual uranium and thorium. So, for example, you wouldn't want to put a neutrino detector under one of the Rocky Mountains, because those Rocky Mountains have lots of igneous material in them, which means there'd be a lot of residual uranium and thorium in the vicinity. And so by putting it under a really big limestone mountain, they're able to guard against that uranium and thorium. Now, if you go thousands of feet below the earth, you got uranium and thorium, and they're actually using this detector to measure the neutrinos that come from the decay of uranium and thorium deep underground the earth. And I got all this coming in my next book. And by the way, I think we got a new title change or proposed title change. We're going to call it Cosmic Interior Designs. However, our marketing team could change that title again as well. But I've already completed the chapter and how they've used this neutrino detector in Gran Sasso to accurately measure the neutrinos coming of the sun and determine why the sun is so different from other stars and being extremely stable. But also, it has been used to determine the flow of neutrinos from the interior of the Earth and actually give us an unprecedented look at the design that we see in the deep interior layers of the Earth. And this all got published literally just a few months ago, some of it just a few weeks ago, but it is in the new book.
Hugh, I guess one of the parts of the question is the detector directional? Can it determine what direction the neutrinos are coming from?
It's not that directional. I mean, it does have some directional capability, but it's not that very, very good. But you get a different predicted neutrino flow from the proton-proton reaction in the sun than you do from the carbon-nitrogen-oxygen nuclear reaction. And so they can distinguish between those two. And they can also distinguish between neutrinos coming from the proton-proton reaction and coming from the decay of uranium and thorium. So in that sense, you get some directionality. But in terms of being able to pinpoint a spot, no, I really can't do that. On the other hand, they do have neutrino detectors in other parts of the world. So for example, another really sensitive neutrino detector is in the nickel mine in Sudbury, Ontario. There they've got a very deep nickel mine, and so they carved out a big cavern and have put a neutrino detector there. Another one is in Japan, likewise deep underground. So there are a few places in the world where you can find both really good protection from cosmic radiation, as well as really good protection from the uranium and thorium in igneous rocks. But the two best detectors are in Sudbury, Ontario, and in Gran Sasso in Italy. And the one in Gran Sasso, Italy, does rank as the world's most sensitive neutrino detector.
So would that detector tell us if a solar flare was headed our way?
Well, yeah, the Gran Sasso is not going to help you determine a solar flare. And by the way, you don't need it. You can just have a look at the sun, and if you see a big flare coming off of its surface, that tells you that a flare happened. So you don't need anything as sophisticated as a Gran Sasso neutrino detector. As I mentioned already, it's not going to give you information what's going on in the surface of the sun, only the deep interior of the sun.
Okay, the other two questions will probably take a while, so
What are we saving for next week? And what I'm going to do is share a screen again so you can see the URL. Okay, this is a study question that we're going to have. It's actually a testimony time. I'm going to begin with a couple of short stories from my own life. Then I want to really encourage those of you that are part of the meeting, likewise, to give an account. And actually, what I'm challenging all of you, whether you're part of the meeting or not, to be prepared to give this kind of account. So if you can't think of one off the top of your head, really give this some meditation. Look back in your life and, hey, if you're over the age of 15, I'm sure you can think of an event in your life that looked really terrible, looked like it was impossible to work out for anything good. But as time went by, whether it be days, weeks, or years, you eventually saw the good, and it was something that just completely blew you away. That's what I want you to think about, be willing to share with us. And by the way, I always like to practice on fellow believers, share something like this with fellow believers, then be ready to share with unbelievers, because God will give you opportunities. And God will use those opportunities to enable these people to come in faith to Christ. So I'm basically challenging all of you, get prepared, get ready, and we're going to start in our web meeting. And this is the URL you're going to need. So in case you don't have it from last week or the weeks before, it's the same URL we used before. And the way this works, I'm going to shut down the webinar, but all of you need to leave the webinar other than the Zoom feature, and then go put this into your URL address. Put this in, it'll automatically take you to the meeting. And once you're in the meeting, wait for me to take you out of the waiting room and put you in the meeting. And I'm hoping with the Zoom upgrade I just put in, I'll be able to do it automatically, but I won't know until I give it a try. So this is what you're going to need, and take a screenshot if you need to. Or write it down. The key will be those last 11 digits to get you in, and you will not need a password, but you will need to leave the webinar in order to do this. So with that, I'm going to stop the share feature, and I'm going to end the webinar, and I'll see all of you in the meeting that choose to join. All right, see you in a couple of minutes.